Okay, it's my pleasure this morning to introduce Professor Benny Morris. If you were here last night, you heard him. And Professor Morris teaches history at Ben-Gurion University. He has a PhD in modern European history at Cambridge. He's worked as a journalist in various posts, but is best known for his numerous books on the Israel-Arab conflict, including Righteous Victims, A History of the Zionist Arab Conflict, 1948, A History of the First Arab-Israeli War, and more recently, One State, Two States. Professor Morris has written for the New York Times, Newsweek, The New Republic, The New York Review of Books, many other publications. He lives in Lyon, Israel, is married with three children. Please welcome Benny Morris.
I think it would be a bit slower. Thanks. I'm going to speak about something historical today, which of course does have resonance in the present and, if you like, for the future, about one state and two state solutions to the Israel-Palestine problem. There are really two possible paradigms for a solution, if you like, talking geopolitically. One is a partition or division of the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, called traditionally in the West Palestine, the land of Israel in Hebrew, Eretz Israel, dividing it into two states between the two peoples that inhabit the land, the Jews and the Arabs. Two states. You can have, of course, you can subdivide that paradigm into a number of possibilities. You can have a state rule. You can have a Jewish state with an Arab minority side by side with an Arab state with a Jewish minority, or a Jewish state without an Arab minority side by side with an Arab state without a minority. But that's the one paradigm for a solution, a partitioned Palestine with two states. The other paradigm, the other basic paradigm for a solution of the problem is a one-state solution, meaning that there will be one government encompassing, ruling over the whole area from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, and that a state could also be subdivided, this paradigm could be subdivided also into a number of possibilities. You could have one state only with Jews, meaning killing or expelling all the Arabs from it. You could have one state being an Arab state without any Jews, meaning killing all the Jews or expelling all the Jews from the area. Or you could have one state which is in some way with Jews and Arabs living in it, sharing power in some way, one of them being a minority, one of them a majority, but a one-state solution with the two peoples living in it. There is, of course, a third possibility, incidentally, which was a possibility which actually existed under the Ottomans and under the British, and that is a foreign power, not the Jews or the Arabs, ruling over the land, but a foreign power ruling over the whole of Palestine, as I said, existed under Ottoman rule for four centuries, under the British for 30 years. But given the 21st century norms, it's not really conceivable that another power will rule over the area in place of Jews or Arabs, with Jews and Arabs living in this state ruled by a third party. So it's not something which is likely or even conceivable in any way. Now, these two paradigms of one-state solution or two-state solution have been on the table since the start of the Zionist enterprise in 1882. And initially, both national movements, Zionism from 1882 and the Palestinian Arab National Movement, and you can date it from whenever it began, there are arguments about that among historians, but most historians agree that it starts out, the Palestinian National Movement, as a separate Arab national movement, separate from the Syrian national movement, separate from the Egyptian Arab national movement. It starts out somewhere in the 1920s and gains momentum and adherence. More and more Palestinians become nationally conscious as the decades advance from the 1920s on. But the 1920s is when you can sort of say it begins. From the start, both national movements wanted a one-state solution, wanted all of Palestine for themselves. The Jewish national movement, the Zionism, from 1882, at least down to the mid-1930s, until the Arab revolt, and some people might even say down to 1947, wanted all of Palestine for itself. With an Arab minority, without an Arab minority, all of Palestine should be under Jewish sovereignty. The Arab national movement, as I say, from the 1920s, wanted all of Palestine, a one-state solution with a Jewish minority, without a Jewish minority. And to my, in my understanding, until the present time, they still want a one-state solution. Zionism changed, and there was a difference in the trajectories of the two national movements. Zionism changed in its basic attitude to a resolution of the conflict in the late 1930s, if you like, in a process from 19, we can actually date it from 1937 until 1947. Between those years, during those years, Zionism switched from wanting a one-state solution and all of Palestine under Jewish sovereignty to the idea of a partitioned Palestine, a two-state solution. And essentially on the table in terms of Zionism since 1947 has been the two-state solution. Now I'll go into this a little bit, if you like, in greater detail. Zionism adopted the two-state solution, or began the conversion to adoption of a two-state solution instead of what it had believed for 50 years, a one-state solution, in July 1937. In July 1937, the Peel Commission, a British Royal Commission, sent out to investigate the reason for the Arab rioting or rebellion of 1936, and sent out also to find a solution to the conflict in Palestine. The Peel Commission in July 1937 submitted its report to the British government, which incidentally was endorsed immediately by the British government, like all Royal Commission reports are traditionally by British governments. The Peel Commission said there is no solution except partition. The Jews should receive, that's what the Peel Commission said, something like less than just under 20% of the land of Palestine for Jewish sovereignty. The Arabs should receive something like 70% to be attached later to the Emirate of Transjordan, which was then ruled by Abdullah, one of the British agents or wards in the Middle East. But it should be an Arab state, Transjordan, plus the bulk of Palestine, and the Jews would get something under 20%, remaining sort of 10% of the country, including Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and a route to the sea at Jaffa, should be under continued British control. Being Christian sites important to Christendom, shouldn't be in the hands of Jews or Arabs. The Jews responded, the mainstream of the Zionist movement responded to the Peel Commission proposal for a partition of Palestine by endorsing the principle of a two-state solution. A Zionist Congress was called an emergency session, I think it was in Zurich in August 1937, and it endorsed, under Ben-Gurion's and Weizmann's tutelage, it endorsed a two-state solution by a majority of 2-1, except they did write back to the British saying, we can't agree to 17% only for the Jews, we must increase the percentage, it's open for negotiation, let's negotiate. But they accepted the principle of partition. Now, when you look at the documentation from the period about all of this, you do find that Ben-Gurion may have been a little manipulative, and Ben-Gurion was, from 1935 on, the head of the Zionist movement, the chairman of the Jewish Agency Executive, therefore the most powerful man in Zionism, especially in Palestine. He wrote to his son, he wrote in one or two diary entries, that, well, we'll accept this small mini-state which the British Peel are offering us, but we will use it as a base for later expansion around Palestine, throughout Palestine. So in other words, his acceptance of partition may have been a bit duplicitous, at least of the principle of partition. Certainly the British plan itself may have been a bit duplicitous, because he did, in his heart at least, that's how he wrote his son Amos in a famous letter in July, he did think of using it, the area which was given to the Jews, as a base for further expansion, not exactly wholehearted acceptance of the idea of partition. I would say that it took the Zionist movement under Ben-Gurion about 10 years to digest the principle of partition and to accept it wholeheartedly. And the Zionist movement, after the Holocaust happens, other things happen, and by 1947, when the United Nations puts on the table another proposal for partition in Palestine, the famous resolution, General Assembly Resolution 181 of November 29, 1947. At that point, when the Jews say yes, the Jewish agency says yes to the new partition proposal, it's a wholehearted acceptance, in my view, by the mainstream of Zionism. It's true that alongside the acceptance by the mainstream, meaning Mapai and the liberal parties in Zionism, the main Labour Party, the main Labour or Socialist Party in Zionism, and its aligned liberal parties, there was also opposition, both in 1937 to the partition proposal, to the idea of partition, and in 1947 when the UN passed its resolution, there was also opposition by the right, under the revisionists later called Herut, later called the Likud, and by one wing of the socialist Zionist camp, the Achdut HaAvodah, who believed in Greater Israel, what is called, we shouldn't agree to a partition to give up any part of Palestine. But these were minor elements in the Zionist movement. The mainstream accepted by 1947 wholeheartedly the principle of partition, and that's in effect what happened in the 1948 war. There was a partition. Arabs got some part of Palestine, the West Bank, Gaza Strip, the remainder came under Jewish sovereignty. I would say that since 1948, the mainstream of Zionism, the bulk of the Zionist camp, the bulk of Israel's citizenry, has accepted the principle of partition as inevitable, that you cannot have all of the greater Israel, you can't have it, you can't have the whole land, it has to be partitioned. Because of internal reasons, because of moral considerations, because there's a large number of Arabs living in the country, because the world won't let you have the whole of Palestine, ultimately they accepted the principle of partition. There was and this applies to Likud-led governments, this applies to Kadima-led governments, this applies to Labour-led governments, from 1948 down to 2011, to the present day. The bulk of Israelis, the bulk of Israeli political parties accept the principle of partition. There was a gap, there is a hiatus there, there is a hiatus in this acceptance of partition. The 67 war provoked expansionist urges among Israel's Jews. The right wing took power as a belated result of what had happened in 67 and 73. In 1977, Israel has its first right wing government under Menachem Begin from 1977 for a few years. And during the 77-92 period, when the Likud is ascendant in Israeli politics, I would say the bulk of Israelis maybe withdrew from acceptance of partition, but this is a 15-year period in, if you like, a total period ranging from 37 until 2011, so it's like a blip on the screen in which it withdraws from acceptance of partition. By and large, during this whole period of 70, 80 years, whatever it is, the Zionist movement, the mainstream, including today the Likud, accept the principle of a partitioned Palestine, a two-state solution. Let me add one other small element to this. From 1925 onwards, and very briefly, and only among a small proportion of Jews, and you'll find several hundred adherents of this among the Jews in Palestine to this day, a small segment of the Jews, but they were important in the 20s, 30s, and 40s because they were individually people with great merit, supported a binational solution. Continued, if you like, to support a one-state solution, but a binational type of one-state in which there would be some form of parity dual control of this one state by the Jews and Arabs. They would have one government, 6 Jewish cabinet ministers, 6 Arab cabinet ministers. They would control the country together in a binational state. This began with a movement called Brit Shalom in 1925. Brit Shalom sort of faded and died. It was replaced in 1942 by another movement, small, called Ichud, Agudat Ichud. And these propounded a binational state, which is something, incidentally, which is now returning in some way to the dialogue or the discourse on solutions to Palestine, especially by left-wing or extreme left-wing or anti-Zionist Jews abroad, Jewish intellectuals like Tony Judd, are talking about a one-state binational solution. Why was it important? Why do I bring this up? Because though Brit Shalom probably had something like 500 members in the 1920s, they included people who were very important, like the president of the Hebrew University, Yehuda Leib Magnus. Later, they included people like Martin Buber, Gershom Scholem, people who were very important in the intellectual life and culture of the country. And so they had, as they say, much greater weight, and Ben-Gurion listened to them. Magnus was a very good speaker, very good advocate for his cause in the 40s. So they had much more, received a lot of attention also from the Americans, American government, from the British government, but it was way out of proportion to their real numbers, their real support among the Jewish public in Palestine. But you have to be aware of this. There was a binational, small binational stream in Zionism calling for a one-state solution, parity between Jews and Arabs, which has, as I said, in recent years, been resurrected in some way in the West, especially in the West, not in Israel, though there may be a few adherents in Israel to the idea as well, but they're negligible in terms of numbers. The Palestinian national movement from the 1920s had a different trajectory, as I said, and they believed from inception that there should be a one-state solution. All of Palestine is ours, maybe with some Jews, with some Jewish minority, maybe without. All of Palestine, river to sea, should be under Palestinian control. The Third Palestine Congress, this was, if you like, in some way augured or embodied in the resolutions of the Third Palestine Arab Congress, December 1920, which you can say is in some way the launching pad of Palestinian Arab nationalism. They wrote in their resolutions of December 1920, they were meeting several dozen notables representing the Arabs, they were meeting in Haifa, they wrote, Palestine is the holy land, please note, of the two Christian and Muslim worlds, and its destiny may not pass into other than Muslim and Christian hands. The Balfour Declaration, which had been passed 3 years before, issued 3 years before by the British government, they declared contrary to the laws of man and God. In 1937, when the two-state solution was put on the table by the Peel Commission, by Britain, Haj Amin al-Husseini, by then the head of the Palestine National Movement, rejected completely any idea of partition, any inch of Palestine for Jewish sovereignty. All of it must be ours. Even the opposition, Husseini in the Palestinian camp had opposition from a group around a family called Nashashibi. Some people called them moderates in the Palestinian camp, the Nashashibis, but they too said Palestine should be an independent Arab state without any Jewish or foreign rule in response to the Peel Commission recommendation. What I'm saying is there was unity in the Palestinian camp on this issue. There wasn't divided councils. One state is what they wanted, all of the Palestinian national movement. And this was continued in the 1960s. It's embodied in the Palestine National Charter of 1964. Zionism is evil, illegal. The aim of the Palestine National Movement, the PLO, as it was called, the aim is the elimination of Zionism in Palestine, as it was put, all of Palestine. If you like, with some respect for different religious minorities. The Fatah Constitution, the constitution of the main political party which led the Palestine National Movement in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, until you can say maybe the Hamas in some way replaced it as the leading body in Palestinian politics. The Fatah Constitution of 1964 also speaks of the complete liberation of Palestine. In 1978, when Anwar Sadat and Begin began to negotiate the Egypt-Israel peace treaty, which was eventually signed in 1979. In 78, they issued a preliminary document called the Camp David Accords, part of which was devoted to the Palestinian issue. And in that part of the Camp David Accords signed between these two leaders in 1978, a solution to the Palestinian problem was outlined, and it was called autonomy. The Palestinian territories, West Bank and Gaza Strip, should receive autonomy, in some form of autonomy with a legislative council. And most critics of the agreement from the right said this will lead inevitably to a Palestinian state. Autonomy, an autonomous area, would eventually devolve into a full-fledged state. Begin, I think, was aware of this, but he also probably counted on the Palestinians to reject this solution, autonomous area, and that's in fact what happened. Yasser Arafat, if you like, in Husseini's wake, rejected the Begin-Sadat proposal for autonomy, and we find Arafat essentially doing the same thing in the year 2000 when a proper two-state solution is put on the table by then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and subsequently even improved on by President Clinton in his parameters of December 2000, a Palestinian state in 94-96% of the West Bank, 100% of the Gaza Strip, half of Jerusalem, all of, or a large part, three-quarters, say, of East Jerusalem, a Palestinian control over the surface area of the Temple Mount, and so on. All of this package is rejected by Arafat also in the year 2000. So what we have... maybe I should add to this one another episode which completes this, the trajectory, and that is that after Husseini and after Arafat, you have, after Arafat dies, I think it's 2004, Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, becomes the president of the Palestinian Authority, and he too enters negotiations with the Israelis, which are presumably based on the idea of a two-state solution, with Ehud Olmert, then prime minister. And in 2008, Ehud Olmert submits to Abbas a two-state solution, which more or less is in conformity with the Clinton parameters, maybe slightly improving on them. And here, too, Abbas, in effect, rejects the Olmert proposals. He simply doesn't respond. And then the weeks pass, and then Olmert, of course, is deposed because of... all sorts of corruption attached to his name. He's now on trial, but this is sort of irrelevant. What's relevant is that Abbas is offered a two-state solution, slightly improved on the Clinton parameters, and again, in effect, says no to the Israeli proposals, in line consistently with the leadership of the Palestinian National Movement since its inception in the 1920s. Since then, if you like, under Abbas, there has been with one excuse or another, usually the settlements is the primary excuse, there's been a continued effort by Israel under Netanyahu to reopen these negotiations with the Palestinians, Abbas has continuously avoided re-entering these negotiations, which essentially means he's uninterested, to me, my interpretation is he's uninterested in negotiating and reaching a two-state solution, sticking to the Palestinian long-term vision of one Palestinian state in all of Palestine. Now, I've been talking all the time, if you like, about the mainstream of the Palestinian National Movement. On its side, if you like, or side by side with it, you've got the Hamas. The Hamas is a fundamentalist organization. Its charter from 1988 calls explicitly for Israel's destruction through jihad. No Arab leader can sign away any part of Palestine to other sovereignty, to non-Muslim sovereignty. That's what it says there, and rejects totally any idea of another people, the Jews, ruling over any inch of Palestine. As they put it, the Hamas in the charter, the Hamas from 1988, the Hamas strives to raise the banner of Allah over every inch of Palestine. Now, why is that important? It's gained in importance politically because the Hamas emerged from the Second Intifada as the dominant party, the most popular party, if you like, among the Palestinians. They control the Gaza Strip physically today. They don't control the West Bank because basically of Israeli bayonets. Israel is behind Abbas controlling the West Bank and won't allow the Hamas to take over the West Bank, though conceivably if there are elections, and there might soon be elections in the West Bank as well soon, conceivably the Hamas will win a majority there. But what I'm saying is in the year 2006, there were elections in the territories which are were seen by observers, foreign observers, as fair. And these elections in 2006 gave the Hamas a majority in the Palestinian legislature, a majority in the Palestinian political arena. So the Hamas isn't a negligible, small, even albeit extreme force. It represents, if not a majority of Palestinians, at least 40 to 50% of them. And probably more if there are free elections today in the West Bank, we would find this out. So the Palestinian camp remains united, I would say, in rejection of a two-state solution, though Abbas talks about accepting a two-state solution, but always adds the caveat that the other state, the non-Palestinian state, side by side with which Palestine is to live, shouldn't be a Jewish state. He refuses to accept the formula of two states for two peoples. Two states, yes, but not two states for two peoples. In other words, the Jews should not have a state of their own. Israel, the implication being that Israel, at some point down the road, should also become a Palestinian Arab majority state, either by virtue of Arab birth rates, which are greater, of course, than Jewish birth rates, or by virtue of a refugee return, which he also demands, to the area of the State of Israel. These two in combination will bring about an Arab majority in that other state, which he refuses to call a Jewish state. Now, there is a geographic... Now let me return to the business of the one-state solution. There is a logic to the one-state solution, which, as I say, has been resurrected by a large number of Palestinian and pro-Palestinian intellectuals in the last few years, against the backdrop of the failure of the two sides to negotiate a two-state solution. The idea of a two-state solution is going nowhere. The Palestinians blame Israeli settlements. Israelis like myself would blame Palestinians for being unwilling to go into a two-state solution. But there is a failure in the negotiation for a two-state solution, which has led various Western intellectuals, by default, to say, okay, let's return to the one-state idea, Jews and Arabs living together in Palestine. And as I say, there is a geographic logic to a one-state solution, because Palestine isn't Russia. It's a very, very small land. It's a very small area, 50 miles more or less from the sea to the river in width. It's very difficult to divide in any normal, acceptable, there's no natural borders if you divide the country in two. There are natural borders if you have a one-state solution. You've got a sea, you've got a river, and so on, a Gulf of Aqaba in the south. Water tables, in terms of water, you can't divide the land in terms of exploiting and using water resources, because much of the water used by the area which is called Israel, much of the water is derived from underneath the West Bank, the water tables in the West Bank. The sewage systems of the two countries, if you divided them, wouldn't work. They have to be united for sewage to move from the highlands, which are Arab-dominated and presumably would be the Arab state, down into the coastal plain. Today you've got sewage going down the rivers or down the streams or the dry riverbeds into the Israeli coastal plain, the Jewish populated coastal plain. It has to be united, otherwise it won't work. Maritime outlets. An Arab state which would be in the West Bank it wouldn't really have a maritime outlet. It could be connected to Gaza. Maybe you can build a proper port in Gaza. But at the moment, the maritime outlets, Ashdod, Haifa, are on the Jewish in the Jewish areas, Eilat. Again, you can't have a viable Palestinian state based on the West Bank without a maritime outlet. So there's good reason for a one-state solution. It makes a lot of geographic sense, economic sense, environmental sense, and so on. The problem is that demography over the span of history, demography has trumped geography. The two peoples, basically, cannot live together. This has been demonstrated by endless terrorism, counter-terrorism clashes. And the Peel Commission in 1937, and incidentally, I recommend anybody who has access can get access to it, to read the Peel Commission report if he wants to understand what is happening in Palestine, because that document, 400 pages long, from 1937, is a wonderful description of what was going on and is relevant to this day. The Peel Commission, on this particular point of two peoples who cannot live together, and it said we should not have one people dominating the other. That's why we have to have partition and even a transfer of the Arabs out of the area of the Jewish state to be into the Arab area, because we shouldn't have Jews dominating and ruling over Arabs or Arabs ruling over Jews. That's why we must have total separation of the two peoples. The Peel Commission wrote this: there is no common ground between them, between these two peoples living in Palestine, 1937. The Arab community is predominantly Asiatic in character, the Jewish community predominantly European. They differ in religion and in language, their cultural and social life, their ways of thought and conduct are as incompatible as their national aspirations. And what they wrote in 1937 is even truer today, given another 80 or so years of blood flowing between the two sides and deepened hatreds as a result. Even one of the Arab leaders, Musa Kazim al-Husseini, the uncle of Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the head of the Arab Executive Committee in the 1920s, which preceded Haj Amin al-Husseini's Arab Higher Committee, in 1922 wrote Musa Kazim al-Husseini, who was, as I say, in some way the head of the Palestine National Movement at its inception in the 20s, nature does not allow the creation of a spirit of cooperation between peoples so different. That's how he put it in 1922 to explain why they cannot live together. But he, of course, wanted not separation, not two states, but all of Palestine without Jews. Now, what the Peel Commission was really pointing to in 37 when it said the peoples are so diverse, he used the word Asiatic, European, and so on, he meant, I think, a basic difference in values. And it's a problem of values. Not so much language, though language, of course, is important. I mean, there's a place called Belgium in which they're about to fall apart over just one small thing, which is called language. They have shared Christian values and shared everything else. The values we're talking about are different, the values of each of the communities in Palestine in 1937 and today. You can look at the litmus tests, if you like, are the value put on human life, which on one side leads to suicide bombings, the tolerance of the other. Look at the treatment of Christians and Jews in the Arab world in general, also in Palestine vis-a-vis the Christians. Very few Christians, I don't know if you know, but in Palestine itself, in 1947, the Palestinian Arab community was 90% Muslim, 10% Christian. Today, the Palestinian Arab community is probably something like 3-4% Christian, which means a lot of Christians have drifted off to the West, and this continues to be so. Towns which used to be mostly Christian, like Bethlehem and Bejala, are today mostly Christian, mostly Muslim. Tolerance of the other, of course, in terms of the values, position of women in society, homosexuals in society, and so on. In all these categories, one sees that there is a difference, a major difference, a chasm, if you like, between the two societies and their values when it comes to tolerance and so on. So what I'm saying about the Peel Commission and its recipe of two states its denial of the possibility of a one-state solution, one can add to it, and here I'm, if you like, in some way arguing with the one-statists who've emerged in the West and in Palestine as well, is that there can't ever really be a binational state in which there is parity between two peoples. Because at any given moment in time, one of the peoples will have more, greater numbers than the other. And therefore, if it's a democracy, necessarily greater representation in the parliament and in the government which rules. You cannot actually achieve real parity between two communities if it's based on one man, one vote. You can if it's not democratic and you artificially assign equal power to two communities, whatever their numbers, but if it's based on democracy, it can't actually last because there will always be an imbalance at some point and a greater imbalance, as I say, in favor of the Arab side, given Arab birth rates and a refugee return down the years. Probably, though, the last and most important objection to a one-state solution is that neither people wants it. The whole idea of Zionism, from the Zionist perspective, the Jewish side, the whole idea of Zionism was to establish at long last in the world, after 2,000 years, a state in which Jews will rule themselves and be a majority in that country, but rule themselves. And the same applies on the, and that means, of course, a state ruled by the Jews, not a one-state solution in which there's some sort of parity of control, or maybe majority Arab control down the road because of increased demography. On the Arab side, it's equally true. They don't want and never wanted and always rejected much more consistently than the Jews the idea of a binational state. In the 1920s and 30s, when people like Magnus and Buber and Sholem approached the Arabs to find a partner for a binational state, they never found one. There may have been one or two odd Arabs who, for various vengeful reasons, didn't want Husseini and said, yes, yes, let's have a binational state. But they were shot by Husseini agents. They couldn't find a partner. And this is what Magnus said, sadly, from his point of view, I cannot find partners in the Arab community in Palestine to share in this binational vision. And that's essentially why it died in the 30s and 40s, apart, of course, from Zionist objections. So this dislike or unacceptability by the majority of Arabs and the majority of Jews of a two-state solution essentially torpedoes any possibility of a one-state solution and binational state in Palestine. Okay, that's what I just wanted to say as remarks. Please, if there are any questions. Yeah. Ah.
When the division of the Ottoman Empire took place...
Say that again?
When the division of the Ottoman Empire took place...
Yep.
In the 1920s...
Well, 1918, 1920,
the League of Nations, right?
Well, 1917, 1921, when the Ottoman Empire was defeated in
Wasn't it the intention that Jordan was going to be that second Arab state alongside the Jewish state?
No, it wasn't seen that way. Look, when the Ottoman Empire collapsed under because of British victory at the end of World War I, it was shared out. The Arab lands in the Ottoman Empire were in some way divided and then shared out into zones of British and French influence, and some areas zones of direct French and British control. It wasn't seen... There was the idea of having some form of Zionist national home in Palestine, but nobody said, well, next to it, we have to have an Arab state. It wasn't done that way. The states which emerged, that is, the political entities which emerged, which became mandated territories under French and British direction, and eventually independent states, Syria, Lebanon, Transjordan, were simply divided by these countries as a result of various imperial interests and local national movements among the Arabs, who didn't want to be ruled, say, by somebody from Saudi Arabia, which was the initial intention in some ways of the Arab revolt of 1916-1918. But it had nothing to do with dividing the area between Jews and Arabs. The Jews were allotted in the Balfour Declaration and later by League of Nations mandated charters, the area in Palestine. And that's it, yeah.
Good morning. In your analysis of the contemporary mindset of Arab leadership, you did not at all mention the recent revelations and the leaks, the WikiLeaks, those documents. Do you not find them credible, or what? Could you comment on that?
You can an Arab representative, a Palestinian representative, can say to an American emissary, and that's what these WikiLeaks are, basically leaks of Arab and other meetings with American representatives, or just said in other ways by Arab representative can say to an American in a back room discussion, yes, we're willing to give up the right of return, or yes, the Jews can have 96% of Palestine, we don't care. He can say whatever he wants to an American representative, and then it'll go down in the report by the American representative of the conversation, which will go to Washington and then be leaked by somebody in Washington. It's meaningless. What's important in terms of what the Palestinians are willing to concede or not willing to concede is what is ultimately signed. If you sign nothing at the end of 5 years of negotiation, nothing that has been said in the negotiation has any real relevance, because you can say whatever you like. As long as you don't sign, it's all nonsense. Do you understand what I'm saying? And this is what has been leaked. The willingness of the Palestinians to reach a two-state solution, to give up the right of return, to give up areas of the large settlement blocks and so on in an exchange of territory, which will be more or less required by any two-state solution, more or less along the Clinton parameters, will be determined by what they are willing to sign at the end of the day, not by various leaks along the way in conversations with American representatives. Yeah.
This morning, you've shown quite realistically how both a two-state solution and a one-state solution, given the present political context, can't be realized. Which leads me to wonder about another solution that you seem to have avoided. As someone mentioned, Jordan. In 1922, Britain violated its own mandate by setting up Transjordan. It was in complete violation of the League of Nations mandate to the British government. That being the case, you have Transjordan now, renamed Jordan. Why not expel the Arabs from Judea and Samaria to Jordan, where their countrymen pose a majority of people already, and where, since Transjordan was Palestine across the Jordan, you've got part of Palestine already there, and leave the rest of Judea and Samaria and Israel for the Jews. Now, it seems to me that we're using settlements euphemistically. When the Arabs refer to the settlements, they're not talking about the settlements in Judea and Samaria. They're talking about populated areas in Israel. So what they really want, and you admit it, is the disappearance of Israel from the map. Whether you call them Fatah or whether you call them Hamas, there's no difference. So why not use the Transjordan that exists?
Okay.
But one more point. One more point.
No. Let me respond to that, please, and give others a chance. There is a myth that the mandate also included, that is included, Palestine and Transjordan. The truth is that formally the mandate, the League of Nations mandate to Britain to be in charge of this area is called the Mandate for Palestine and Transjordan. And the High Commissioner of England, of Britain, who ruled in Jerusalem, in Palestine until 1948, his official title was High Commissioner for Palestine and Transjordan. But this was only a facade. In truth, the League of Nations mandate from 1922 said that Transjordan should not be included in the mandate in the sense of possible Jewish settlement. In other words, the League of Nations mandate limited, restricted Jewish settlement in Palestine and the idea of a Jewish national home, and that's explicitly in the League of Nations mandate, to Palestine and excluded from it Transjordan. It's true that in 1921, the British, in effect, lopped off Transjordan from this mandated area, gave it to a prince, in fact for 6 months, later it was extended, to rule over one of the Hashemite princes, a man called Abdullah, and eventually Abdullah became the ruler of Transjordan, and Transjordan became an independent state in 1946. But in 1922, the lopping off was a formality in the sense that the mandate itself excluded Transjordan from Jewish settlement and from the Jewish national home. You're talking about settlements, it's true. Sometimes Arab spokesmen, when they're talking about settlements, are speaking of both settlements in the West Bank, but also of Jewish towns and so on in Israel proper, Haifa, Tel Aviv, and so on. And sometimes when they talk about settlements, it is actually restricted to the West Bank. So it depends. They use this term in various ways. It depends what the contexts are. Please.
Thank you. It was a very good talk.
Let me add one sentence to the... You talk blithely about expelling people from Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. You'd probably want to include Gaza as well, which is even more prickly, across the Jordan. Expelling people involves a great deal of suffering, and in any case, it's not something which is practical. The world will not allow you to do it. And Jewish public opinion in Israel won't allow you to do it. Yeah. I don't understand. Okay, you can expel Jews. That's the way the world works. What can we do? Russia can expel Chechens or somebody else or Tatars or whoever they want. We can't expel several million Arabs. It's not something which is practical. It's not something which is moral. It's not something which the Israeli public will stand for. And it's not something the world and the Arab world will stand for. So it's not going to happen. Unless in apocalyptic circumstances, maybe then something really unusual can happen. But not in normal circumstances. Wait, there's the line. Sorry. Yes, okay, please.
My question is...
There's a protocol here. If you want to ask a question, by all means, please step up in line.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you.
Sorry.
So, given Palestinians' continuous rejection of a Jewish state, and in the hope that one day they'll be a partner for peace, regarding settlements, why isn't it in Israel's interest to have settlements not in the middle of heavily populated Arab populated areas, but in areas that would thicken Israel's border and in strategic areas that will improve Israel's security, given that there's no partner, that they always violated their commitments, etc. So why isn't Israel allowed to actually take care of its own interests and do something?
Well, Israel has been doing both. Israel has been thickening or expanding its borders, the borders of pre 67 Israel, by settling along those borders, and large blocks of settlements exist more or less on the old border on the Arab side of the line. And it also settled Jews and Jewish communities in the spine area of Samaria and Judea, which is heavily populated by Arabs. In other words, putting a lot of Jews in the middle of Hebron, which is a town with 165,000 Arabs. It's done both. The hope, I think, of reasonable Israelis, if there is a two-state solution, is to uproot the settlements from the hilly spine, from the area which is heavily populated by Arabs, where there will inevitably be clashes and friction between Jews living there and Arabs living there, and moving back to the border areas, and maybe retaining, if it's possible, the large blocks of settlements along the border areas. That's more or less the Clinton proposals. That's more or less the proposals of most, in my eyes, reasonable Israelis. The problem is, as you say, and as I say, is that the Palestinians don't really want a two-state solution, so they're not interested in this movement of populations. In fact, they're probably interested in leaving intact the settlements in the core Arab areas so that they are a perpetual source of friction, of bad publicity for Israel, and an obstacle to eventually reaching a two-state solution.
Firstly, I'd like to thank you for all the talks I've heard over the weekend. It's refreshing to have someone who's referred to as the new historian group re-examine his position.
I'm not so new anymore.
Okay, but yeah, they've rejected you now. But re-examine your position and really try to make it in accord with the facts. After your talk last night, I just pointed out to you that Gorenberg made several statements which didn't have any basis in reality. You said, what were they? And then when I told you, you agreed. When I asked him about it, he said he has insider reports. Now, I'm not going to get into that. The question is, you indicated that Abbas rejected Olmert's proposals. In Gorenberg's presentation, he said Abbas didn't reject the proposals, yet we have no deal. People on the left that aren't willing to re-examine their position, and people like J Street, Peace Now, the New Israel Fund, how do they undermine our diplomatic position by throwing out facts which have no basis in reality?
Well, you know, you've mixed up a lot of different people, and I wouldn't put Peace Now in the same category as J Street or Gorenberg or whatever. Peace Now is actually a fairly responsible organization.
Let's exclude them.
Which I have never heard them actually issue things which are untrue, that is, statements. Look, there's a price to democracy. If you want people to think freely and talk freely, you'll have movements which agree with the government, and you'll have movements which disagree with the government, and you'll have some which spread things which are not even true, and this is used by enemies, and that's how it is. Beyond that, I don't know what to tell you. You want to turn into a dictatorship, put everybody in jail. That's a solution, but it's not a solution which is acceptable to most Israelis. They're now trying to cut off. The Israeli government is trying, in some ways, to cut off foreign funding for various anti-government organizations in Israel. I think this is a dangerous path. It's a McCarthyist path. It's not going to work anyhow. The courts will never uphold this.
My question was, how does it undermine our diplomatic position?
Well, it does. It undermines. Look, democracies, when the democracies faced Hitler in the 1930s, before the war, various things were said and done in the democracies which undermined the position of the governments of France and Germany in their conflict with Hitler, the diplomatic political conflict. But that's the price democracies pay. I don't know what to tell you about that. You said something about... one specific point. Look, it's true that in the negotiations between Abbas and Olmert in 2008... Abbas did not say no. He didn't write a letter to the Israeli government or to the American government, said, these proposals are unacceptable to us, we reject them, as Arafat and his people did in 2001 to the Clinton parameters. In January 2001, they rejected in formal writing and so on. But Abbas had weeks after he received the proposals to respond to them. And he didn't respond, because the best position for him was not to respond. Because had he put it in black and white, I reject them, the Americans would have been angry at him, as they had been at Arafat in 2001 for rejecting more or less the same proposals. So he preferred not to say anything. But saying nothing in this case isn't consent, as there is a sort of a thing in Roman law, silence is consent. In this case, silence was rejection. And he also knew that Olmert was under investigation, and eventually there would be a trial, and this would be removed from the table in the sense that Olmert would be removed from the arena, and that's what happened. But in his not answering the proposals, he was essentially saying no, and I think Gorenberg is being disingenuous about this.
Thank you.
Because he could have said yes also, even after Olmert was removed. I got these proposals, I'm saying yes, let's finish the negotiation and sign a peace treaty. He didn't. So he didn't accept them, he rejected them. Yeah.
You, You mentioned in an earlier response that a lot of the rhetoric that comes out of Ramallah is empty and it can't be taken seriously despite it having some positive overtones until something has been signed. But in 1993, I believe, Yasser Arafat signed a letter to Prime Minister Rabin in which the Palestinians recognized Israel's right to exist. And again in 2002 with the Arab Peace Initiative, which was re-endorsed in 2007, Israel was promised normalized relations with the vast majority of its Arab with its Arab neighbors in response for returning to the 67 lines and establishing East Jerusalem as the Palestinian capital. There hasn't been much mention of this today and last night. And my question really is it still possible to divorce Israeli policies in the West Bank from the position of the Palestinians and from the Arabs in general?
I'm not sure what the last part of the question meant. Sorry.
Just essentially, is it possible to still argue that the Israeli policies in the West Bank are not the reason, or not at least part of the reason, for what has otherwise been presented as a wider sense of rejectionism from the Arabs to the concept of a Jewish state?
Okay. Yes, Arafat did sign a letter when recognizing Israel, Israel's right to exist in 1993. This was the beginning of the Oslo process, and Rabin, in exchange, recognized the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people. About a year later, Arafat appeared in a Johannesburg mosque and was recorded. He didn't know that he was being recorded, and told the audience there in very broken English. He often used, incidentally, his broken English to good diplomatic effect, because I didn't really mean that. It was misunderstood. He told the Johannesburg audience that his treaty, his agreement, this was after the signing of the initial Oslo agreement, was similar, this is what he told his audience, that it was similar to Hudnat Hudabiyah, which had been an agreement signed by Muhammad in the 7th century with one of the tribes he was feuding with, an agreement, a non-belligerency agreement, which Muhammad then, within a year, revoked and violated and attacked the tribe and destroyed it. And what Arafat was saying is, what I'm signing with the Jews isn't serious. This is something revocable and violatable, and this is what I will do down the road. When he's speaking to a Muslim audience and doesn't believe he's being recorded, that's what he tells his audience a year after signing the Oslo agreement. So what I'm saying is, what Arafat may have stated or didn't state in 1993 in a formal letter in order to get various things from Israel, which he got, the return of the PLO to the Arab cities of the West Bank and so on, are not really trustworthy, are not serious, are not sincere. And this is how I basically, and I think this incidentally is how most diplomats, Western and Arab, related to Arafat, as somebody who's completely untrustworthy. Everything he says cannot be accepted as truthful in any way. This was his image, and this is how he behaved in various ways. When the Second Intifada broke out, he was continuously telling the Americans, I am trying to limit and restrict and curb the violence, while Israeli intelligence picked up all the signals from his office promoting the violence, which was then spreading around the West Bank and Gaza. The Arab Peace Initiative, I've talked about this, I think, here before, of 2002. It's the Saudi initiative, which was eventually endorsed by the Arab League. I think Israel made a bad mistake in not taking up the Arabs, taking the Arabs at their word. They said they were willing to recognize and accept Israel, normalize relations with Israel in its 1967 boundaries. Israel should have said, yes, let's discuss this, let's negotiate with the Arab League, with Saudi Arabia, and it never did that. Not under Sharon, not under Olmert, not under Netanyahu, and I think this was a bad diplomatic error. They should have called the Arab bluff, and why do I call it a bluff? Because that initiative had two major clauses, which if the Arabs were inflexible about, and they appeared to be inflexible, they more or less said, take it or leave it, this is what it is, we're not going to renegotiate these terms. would have meant Israel's destruction. That's put simply. One of the clauses related to the right of return of the refugees, or the Arab demand, Palestinian demand, which is consensual among the Arabs, that the refugees of 1948 and their descendants be allowed to return to the territory of pre-67 Israel. We're talking about 5 million people. The 2002 peace initiative by the Arabs says that the Palestinian refugee problem must be solved in line with UN General Assembly Resolution 194 of December 1948. And that resolution endorses the right of return because it says Arabs who are peace-minded, that's what it says there, Arabs who are peace-minded should be allowed to return to their homes and lands or accept in lieu compensation. But they should be allowed to return. What that means, and the Arab world accepts that resolution as endorsing their demand for a right of return, if the Arab League insists or insisted on this as the basis of the solution to the refugee problem, as they did, it meant that they will not accept no right of return. They are demanding a right of return, which is something Israel, no Jewish Israeli whom I know who is sane, will accept, because 5 million Arabs returning to the area of the state of Israel in its pre-67 borders means an instant anarchy to begin with. 5 million people pouring across your border in a country which altogether has 7 million people, more or less, means you're in total anarchy, and then means probably an immediate or almost immediate Arab majority in that state. You add 5 million to 1.3 million Israeli Arab citizens, and there are less than 6 million Jews in Israel. It means you have a more or less instant Arab majority in the state, meaning the end of the state of Israel. The other problem in the other provision or clause in the 2002 proposal is adherence to exactly to the letter of, to the last inch of, the 67 borders. The 67 borders, if you do not allow for territorial exchange, means that Israel will have to rehouse, move and rehouse, transfer, if you like, something like 400,000 people. 400,000 people, which in their factories, their homes, their schools, is not something a country like Israel can actually do. It can't be done politically, and it can't be done economically. It's not something which anybody normal will ask for, which is why Clinton and Obama and other American leaders have allowed for an exchange of land, allowing the major blocks of Israeli settlement to be included in Israel in exchange from land from Israel, some land from Israel, to be given in return in compensation to the Palestinians. If you do not allow for this exchange of territory along the old green line, like this peace proposal, you're basically saying Israel should collapse. That's what you're saying. There's no way it can happen. No way Israel can agree to exactly returning to the 67 borders. You may disagree with taking over territory by force, but there are realities to be accounted, and this is the way politics works. You have to take account of what has happened over 40, 50 years, Israeli settlements, so you can perhaps uproot those which are down in the middle of the Arab concentrations of population. You cannot uproot vast towns and cities which have been built since 67 along the line. Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, you said Israel couldn't possibly expel the Arabs from Israel, but the United Nations itself expelled Germans, all the German speakers from Czechoslovakia out of Czechoslovakia at the end of 45. If the United Nations itself can do that, why couldn't Israel do it?
It wasn't the United Nations. It was the Russians and with agreement by the Allies. It was the Allies expelled them.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, but
well, look, the situation is different and the players are different. After World War II, when Hitler had caused what he had caused in Europe, killing whatever he killed, numbers of millions of Russians, Jews, Poles, and so on, the world felt fairly free to move about or to expel German populations who had helped Hitler subvert various states in Europe, like Czechoslovakia and Poland.
Not all of them had helped.
Yes, but the minorities had, basically the minorities, the Sudeten Germans had helped the German, the Hitler case and Hitler physically in doing what he did to Czechoslovakia. And they felt that the world community, the allies basically, felt that these Sudeten Germans deserved it. And what happened, incidentally, was they were accepted by the Germans in Germany and became normal citizens, and there's no longer a German Sudeten refugee problem. This isn't the case of what happened with the Palestinians.
Okay. You said that the original Palestinian mandate, that it was in the Charter of the United Nations, that they...
The League of Nations.
League of Nations, I'm sorry. That east of the Jordan River would not be
open
for
Jewish
settlement.
Yeah.
If that was the case, why was Weizmann so infuriated that they gave that land to the Arabs?
Because they'd hoped, the mainstream of the Zionist movement had hoped that it could retain that land, and he wrote a famous letter to Churchill saying Gilad and Moab and all of the hilly area just across the Jordan really was biblical Israel as well and should be allowed for Jewish settlement. And Churchill said no. He was angry because they lost four-fifths of what they thought might be the territory which would be earmarked for Jewish state. But it wasn't. It wasn't earmarked in the Balfour Declaration, which talked about Palestine west of the Jordan River, and it wasn't earmarked by the United Nations.
But if the United Nations mandate specifically earmarked that as non-Jewish settlement, why would Weizmann even think that?
Because he'd hoped that he could gain it.
All right.
Simple as that.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have some questions for you. The first one is, assuming that everything you've said here is true,
some of it might be.
Your analysis. No, not the facts. Your analysis is true, which is your analysis. What should Israel do? I mean, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that Israel should...
I'm not a politician. I don't know what Israel should do.
No, no, I'm not talking about politics. Politics is between the Likud and Labor. And so I'm saying what should Israeli policy be? You say that there's nothing that Israel can do.
The Clinton parameters are the solution to the Israel-Palestine, Israel-Arab conflict. That's the only way, more or less, that's the solution. So Israel should do things which can lead to that solution. As I say, the Arabs reject that solution, so I don't know what Israel can do.
The other question I have for you is this. You said that in the talks, during Netanyahu's term in office, Abbas has refused to negotiate with Israel.
Yes.
And you've said that it's because of Israelis, because of the excuse of Israel's construction policy.
No, it's because they don't want to negotiate a two-state solution and use the excuse of settlement policy.
Right, yeah. But I want to ask you something in this case. I mean, it's clear that Israel's policy of construction has to do with wanting to keep these territories. That's the reason that they've been building these buildings all along. It's creating facts on the ground, something that the Zionist movement has always used. And so in terms of a period of negotiations, which is theoretically in place since 1992, the fact of creating facts on the ground and affecting the negotiations themselves can be seen as a serious problem.
No, it is a serious problem. I've said in the past, I've always said, the settlements are an obstacle to peace. The settlement venture, which Gorenberg wrote a good book about, was begun in 1967 and then expanded in 1977 by the Israeli Labor Party and subsequently by the Likud in order to hold on to territories, to gain permanent possession of territories. The Likud, all of Greater Israel, Labor, certain areas in the West Bank and whatever. Today, though, the situation isn't like that, because I think the Israeli main parties and the Israeli public has moved away from supporting the idea of Greater Israel. I think most Jewish Israelis believe that it's not possible to gain Greater Israel. They've given up that idea. They've returned to the idea of a two-state solution and partition. In this sense, the settlements which were built on a different basis, on a different assumption, are in some way anachronistic, or they don't belong to the reality of what is of current politics in Israel and surrounding the conflict. And that's one of the problems. An expansion of the settlements, and you're right in this, in some way infuses Arabs with the idea that the Israelis want to hold on to everything, when most Israelis don't. A minority of Israelis do, a majority of Israelis don't, but don't seem able to curb themselves and stop the expansion, some of which is to do with natural needs in the settlements. They need more houses for their children, for their kindergartens and whatever. So there's a sort of a perpetual momentum built up by internal dynamics in expansion. Though I think the vision of Greater Israel, which originally motivated settlements, no longer exists really, except in fringe parties in the Israeli system.
Just a couple of things. I want to apologize for interjecting a comment from the side. Fine. And I want to thank you for your insightful analysis. And without beating it to death, I just don't understand how on the one hand, it can be, you know, we cannot remove anybody anywhere, but it's perfect and it's too expensive and you can't do that and the world won't accept it. But it's okay to uproot 10,000 or 20,000 or 40,000 or 100,000 Jews from wherever they happen to be now and move them back at whatever cost. I don't understand your cognitive dissonance on that.
You may be right that morally it doesn't make sense, but it makes sense politically. And politically ultimately means morally in the greater picture, because basically Israel's population wants peace. And if some of the price for peace is removing some of the population from the West Bank, that's a necessary price, because if you don't do that, you're not going to get peace. So you have to decide what's important to you, the survival and well-being of 6 million Jews or the continued residence in the West Bank of, say, 60,000 who would have to be moved. That's the moral calculus.
Oh, my, the last question. So thank you again. It was wonderful. And if your premise is true that a two-state solution is simply one that will never be accepted in the 70-year discourse... hasn't been in the 70-year discourse, then I'm just confused about how... Wouldn't that then be a defense for a rigorous maintenance of the status quo and a very nihilistic view of where one can go? And your whole argument would say that the Clinton plan is wishful thinking.
It's probably true. But the status quo is untenable. That's the problem. It's untenable. It's untenable politically, internally, demographically for Israel in terms of its relations with the world community. It's just untenable.
You would defend unilateralism then?
I might at some point in time say Israel may have to withdraw unilaterally without an agreement. Yes. This might incidentally be what Arik Sharon was driving at when he began the unilateral move by removing settlements from Gaza and from a small section of the West Bank in 2005. People say he was thinking of doing something similar, knowing that there would not be an agreement with the Palestinians, that he intended unilateral withdrawal to more or less the border fence down the years, but he was struck down and didn't accomplish this.
Professor Morris, thank you very, very much.